Hello, everyone. Welcome to Solidarity Is This. I'm your host, Eva Iyer. So it's hard to believe that we have reached the end of 2018. And if you're new to the Solidarity Is This podcast, I really urge you to take a listen to some of the podcasts that we've been able to produce during the year. We have talked about issues that range from food justice to climate change to the rights of immigrants and refugees. We've talked about various strategies from network building to confronting intergenerational trauma. We've heard from artists and writers and organizers and advocates from all around the country who are doing really transformative work, all with a solidarity lens. So I'm so grateful to all of my guests this year. And we're rounding 2018 out by looking back at some of the movements for change that happened this year in 2018. And we're also looking at what might be on the horizon in 2019. So I'm excited to bring on two guests to our December podcast. We have Jonathan Jays Green, who is one of the co-founders and the director of the UndocuBlack Network. And we also have Jamia Wilson, who is a storyteller, feminist activist, and the current executive director of the Feminist Press. Jamia and Jonathan, welcome to Solidarity Is This.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
So, Jamia, I want to start with you. I want to actually ask you a little bit about what got you into social justice work and particularly the work that you're doing right now at the Feminist Press. I'm always curious to understand what the points of entry are for activists, organizers, and writers. So what is yours?
I have always been inspired by change makers and catalysts. My family has a long history in the civil rights movement, and many of the people in my family self-identify as feminists, and being a part of a family where social activism and community engagement was a big part of our values really moved me to want to make a deeper commitment to my professional path, being in alignment with my personal values. I also grew up in South Carolina for the first part of my life and then moving to Saudi Arabia as a child, and having the experience of seeing inequality in different ways in both of those contexts really opened my eyes about why we need global movement builders who have global vision for change. And the last job I had before I came to the Feminist Press was at Women Action in the Media, where we were doing direct action work to achieve gender justice in the media. And when the former director of Feminist Press said that she was moving on, she had mentioned that she thought that I might be a good fit for the direction that the Feminist Press was going into the future. And now I'm here and really proud to be the youngest director we've had in history, as well as the first woman of color in almost 50 years.
Oh, that's great. So, Jonathan, tell us a little bit about how you got involved in immigrant justice movements and movements for racial justice.
Like a lot of undocumented young people, my point of entry to the immigrant rights movement was in high school when started to really realize the full scale of what it meant to be undocumented and the injustice, right, that we are up against. So that's when I started organizing for immigrants' rights. But with my point of entry really birthing with our co-founders, UndocuBlack, and really like leaning in towards racial justice lens was actually after the Baltimore uprising. As you remember, after the death of Freddie Gray in police custody, and there was a large uprising in Baltimore City really demanding justice and really talking about the structural issues that Black people have been under. And for me, that was a really pivotal point because I had been able to build really deep relationships with Baltimore City young people after they got really involved on the DREAM Act campaign at the state level in Maryland. So to be able to live through those moments and then also be protesting in the street with them on what was happening in Baltimore, and then also seeing the disconnect between the immigrant rights movement and also what was happening in Baltimore to poor Black people. I mean, it just really underlined the fact that people saw these issues as separate. And for people like me who live at that intersection, we couldn't afford to separate those issues. Mm-hmm. I don't get to wake up one day and be undocumented and wake up tomorrow and be Black. I am both every day of the week. So really, you know, wanting to push the conversation, really to have a movement that created space for our communities, Black undocumented people, to be centered, to have a space to heal, to educate each other, and then really to fight for our own liberation.
And you too, Jamia, when you were talking about your point of entry, mentioned desire to build intersectionally, as Jonathan just did, and creating space for intersectional identities and voices to be lifted up. So can you talk a little bit about how the work at the Feminist Press does that?
So the Feminist Press started in 1970. We like to say we've been lit since 1970 to publish classic and new writing from around the world. And we've been elevating silenced and marginalized voices in order to spark empathy and encourage transformation and social justice for all people. And the Feminist Press has existed longer than I have on this earth, which is something profound to think about being in this role, because I had the privilege of growing up reading these books that my mother had on her shelf, and now being a midwife of these new emergent books that are in conversation with those books and a part of the lineage through various waves and conversations within feminism at large. And we began as a really critical component of the second wave feminist publishing movement. We were at that point reprinting feminist classics such as Thora Neale Hurston's book, I Love Myself, and also Charlotte Perkins Gilman's book, The Yellow Wallpaper, but many, many other writers from around the world as well. And now, looking back at some of those books that have been in new second editions, like the But Some of Us Are Brave book, which was the first intersectional Black feminist anthology that was published, that was housed here, it's really great to think about the fact that before, intersectionality was a big, broad part of the public conversation outside of Black feminist circles, that the Feminist Press understood the value of that work and had the vision to see its importance and see the importance of correcting the canon so that all of our voices are lifted up, not just the voices of a select few. And we believe that we're making real impact by publishing The Resistance and by also changing the face of what a very elite industry looks like in terms of who's in the pipeline, who's creating the books at all levels of a book's creation process, from design and also to the operational leadership components of publishing. And so it's exciting for us as a nonprofit publisher, too, that we have people who come into the Feminist Press and leave and go to other bigger publishers and then bring in feminist values into those spaces. And that's a big important part of the work we do as well.
That's great. Thank you so much. And so for folks who are listening, check out the Feminist Press and some of the books that they've published. Put that on your holiday reading list and gift list. So same to you, Jonathan. Want to hear a little bit about UndocuBlack itself, how the organization operates, how do you build with other communities, some of the issues that you've been working on this year?
So the UndocuBlack Network, it's a multi-generational network of undocumented Black people organizing our own communities and building power. So that's really the simplest way I can talk about the network. But it's really both an intervention on the larger movement to really center racial justice as a key component to how we do our work, but also creating spaces for our folks to organize, to heal, to learn from each other, and to really utilize our lived experiences as a guide to how we craft our path to liberation. We believe in a multiple strategies approach because we know that just one approach is not going to get us where we need to be. So we do policy work, both at the national and also state and local level. Some of the policies that we've been fighting for overwhelmingly for this year include TPS, temporary protective status, for all 13 countries that have had it. What's something that most folks don't always realize is that around half of the countries that have had TPS are Black majority countries. So when we talk about TPS, we believe it's a Black issue as well. And then also really looking at some of the other policies that also benefit Black immigrants and African immigrants in particular that don't always get the same level of support. Policies like the diversity visa program and some of the visa sanctions that have been implemented that impact a lot of African countries as well. And then also really fighting Islamophobia and the Muslim ban as well. We know that when we look at the deportation rates for the first two fiscal years of the Trump administration, the group that has had the highest jump in deportations has actually been African countries. And then if you aggregate that by country, Somalia has had the highest jump in deportations. So we know that it's because our folks from Somalia are at the intersection of anti-Blackness and xenophobia, but also Islamophobia. So we need to have a working analysis of how we're fighting Islamophobia and how we're doing that at both the national level, but also at the local level, like supporting campaigns to combat TB and other programs as well. So that's our policy work. There's also our mental illness work as well, because we know that our folks are fighting for our people to be whole and to be well, right? Mm-hmm. And there's so much trauma that we are up against because of all these systems of oppression that we are under. So really, like, creating spaces for our communities to talk about mental illness and then to actually figure out how to put together resources for our folks to be able to access the support that they need. And then lastly, I think it's really around, like, communication and storytelling. We know that storytelling has been a part of our cultural practices for generations, right? And how do we continue to pull back on those practices to really tell our stories and not tell our stories in a way where we are sort of like asking for crumbs, but really telling our stories in a way that honors our history, honors the struggle, and honors where we're going as a community, where we want to go. So those are the strategies that we employ.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. And obviously, I'm sure this year there has been no scarcity of work, given all of those different strategies that you're using. And I really want to encourage... Yeah, and I want to encourage folks to check out UndocuBlack.org. I think that all of the work that you mentioned is transformative, but I think that one of the pieces I just want to lift up is around the mental wellness work that you all are doing and just kind of really emphasizing that, because as I've done these podcasts and obviously work in the community, trauma is something that comes up time and time again. And you all have a model for how you're actually integrating that and not making it an afterthought. So really want to encourage folks to take a look at UndocuBlack.org for that information. You know, I really want to get both of your takes on the movements of the year. So as you know, this is a podcast about solidarity. So, you know, concepts like intersectionality and strategies like storytelling really keep coming up when I have conversations with people around the country, whether they're artists and writers or whether they're organizers or advocates. So I wanted to ask both of you to talk particularly about a couple of the movements that you've had your eyes on that you're part of. So, Jimmy, I want to start with you and specifically ask you about the Me Too movement. And just for some context, earlier this year, I talked to an advocate about the Me Too movement on this podcast, and we discussed some of the real potential of the movement. And we also discussed some of the critiques about it, especially around whether it is inclusive of working class women or the leadership of women of color in particular. So I'm curious to know if you can talk a little bit from your vantage point and also your work that you mentioned that has really been around gender justice and gender equity for so many years. Tell us a little bit about your observations about the strength and potential of the Me Too movement, and also weigh in on some of the critiques around inclusion as well.
I think that the Me Too movement has been so powerful because of its very origins, which was originally a woman of color-driven movement that was driven by Tarana Burke and the amazing work that she had already been doing for many years before celebrities began having the conversation centered around them, and specifically white women being the center of that conversation and all of the different intersectional reasons related to that as it relates to class and structural oppression. And what I think is important for us to remember is that the origins and the roots of why Me Too developed are what we should focus on versus the obstacles that have been put in the way by people who haven't been really close to the movement. And so I'll say that as it relates to the media, that I think that there's been a lot of framing in the media of the Me Too movement being solely about Hollywood and solely about the people who have the largest platforms and the loudest megaphones. But the work that has been happening and so much of the work that has been driven from a community level has origins in communities of color. And one of the things when people talk about Time's Up, for example, that is often left out is that there are domestic workers and farm workers who are integral parts of that movement as well, in addition to celebrities and actors and musicians who are a part of it. And so a big part of it is about a media inequity that we have around the structural imbalance of who has voice, who has editorial power, and who can center a movement or decenter it or render it invisible or silent. I personally was a supporter of Me Too as a survivor. I participated in the New York City Me Too rally. That rally happened at Trump Tower, and it was driven by many different survivors from different backgrounds who were able to stand in community with each other and just tell our stories. And because I had been observing at the time when Me Too was kind of just burgeoning, the decentering of women of color, and specifically Black women too, and this movement, its origins, I decided to bring up with me a copy of the feminist press book, I Still Believe, Anita Hill.
Didn't you write something about that as well, Jamia? Or is it an essay?
I did. I love that you know that. Thank you. Yeah, I did. I wrote an essay in it. And at the time, I ended up speaking at the Anita Hill conference for the 20th anniversary of the hearings. And I spoke about how that was my feminist click moment, because that is when I had learned that there were Black men in my family who understood solidarity as only racial solidarity and expected Black women in the family to be about solidarity when it led to direct threats against Black men, but there wasn't the same sort of energy and sense of obligation from some of them when our rights were threatened as it related to gender-based violence, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really important to me to center that book and to center Anita Hill's name at that time, because I feel as if so many of the trailblazers in this movement, having been women of color who have dared to speak out, are often undermined or left out of the story or made less important to the origins of the movement. And so when the Kavanaugh hearings happened, I thought about this again, and the fact that it was really important for us to lift up Christine Blasey Ford and the very, very courageous work that she did, but also noticing the difference between how the media was covering her testimony and how people at large were responding to her testimony versus what I witnessed as a very young woman happened for Anita Hill. And so for me, I think that the critiques that are out there as it relates to a need for the movement to be much more critically engaged with conversations about race and the centering of women of color and the truth around how the movement emerged. But I still think that the very essence of what Me Too is about, which is about solidarity, which sounds really great to talk about in this podcast, I think is important. And I think the reason why Me Too is threatening to opponents of justice is because it is about releasing stigma. Because if this is something that we can all say, this affects all of us, this is something that you should not be ashamed about, you should not be silent about, because our communities are all plagued by rape culture, are all plagued by abuses of power, then we can really pave new ground. And so for me, I think that aside from some people abusing the power that they have within the context of the conversation about the movement, we can't lose sight of what's most important, and that is about lifting up the voices of survivors and working with survivors to find solutions and justice that comes from a survivor-centered standpoint and a trauma-informed standpoint.
Thank you for sharing that, Jamia. And I think that you are absolutely right to remind us of the origins of not only the Me Too movement, but also reminding us of Anita Hill and the context in which we should look at the Kavanaugh hearings. But Jonathan, same kind of question to you. I mean, you talked about how you and Undocu Black have been at the forefront of so many of the immigrant rights fights this year. And so as you look back on the year, what are some moments you remember when we think about movements like Here to Stay, right? And why do you think these movements have been so powerful in this country?
We're living through a really difficult time, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're basically nearing an authoritarian regime. That's what we're up against in this administration. So the attacks are continuing to come every day. And it's really disheartening so often to like be directly impacted, to be undocumented, to be Black, and all these other different things in this moment, right? And to be clear and all of that. But I think what really gives me hope is the ways in which communities are banded together to fight back, right? Like, I think that has been the highlight of the year. And I have like a couple of examples I want to share. Like, for example, for one, February, Black History Month, you know, we were in the middle of a fight to pass possibly the DREAM Act back then. That's what we were pushing for. And the more I talk about Black immigrants and Black undocumented people, people love to harp on, like, all the divisions between these two communities. People love to talk about, like, the ways in which, like, Black immigrants and, like, African Americans have like historical tensions and like exploiting that to be able to really divide and conquer our communities. But what was really beautiful about February of this year is that we had a moment in which seven Black civil rights leaders actually got arrested at the Capitol Hill, you know, taking the demands of Black immigrants to Paul Ryan. Right? Like, they actually said, you know what, like, you know, we know that you're undocumented and you're really concerned about, you know, civil disobedience, so we'll do that for you.
Right.
And moreover, like, they actually carried our demands, their stories in that process. And I think that was just a transformative moment to be able to say, like, no, we're not divided. We're going to stand together because we're family. We're a diasporic family. I think that one was a beautiful moment. Also, later on in this year, you might have seen on social media that we were fighting for someone named Papa Dumbia.
Yes.
Who it was a beloved community member from Detroit who had been living there for decades, who was picked up by ICE earlier on this year as really a part of their enforcement and targeting of communities that have been criminalized. And I think that they didn't expect our communities to fight back. I think they expected to pick up Papa Dumbia and, you know, have us all sort of like sit down and watch them do that. But what actually ended up happening is that communities locally in Detroit, led by his daughters, the Dumbia sisters, and community leaders like Sadie Starr from Ibiza, and so many other community leaders actually started to organize, working with us as well. Like, we were doing petitions. I think we had like close to 5,000 petitions. They did rallies as well. Congresswoman Lester Sheeda Saeed actually showed up in some of those rallies as well and really pushed back and demanded that their community member was released, to the point that actually one of the nights they tried to deport him without much announcement. And as soon as they got him into the plane, his daughters found out and organized an impromptu rally at the airport and just sat in front of the United Airlines like boarding section until he was released. He was actually released and, you know, taken off the plane. He was not fully released, but, you know, the fact that we were able to show that kind of community power was really beautiful because, again, like, Papa Dumbia is the kind of person that they would want us to believe that it's not worth fighting for, because we are living through a different time, a dangerous time. But what that also means is that it requires us to build deeper. It requires us to be in solidarity with each other. And it requires us to show up when it's time. And, you know, we have to be respectful. We have to do it based on trust and relationships. But we're seeing that, and that is really, that gives me a lot of hope.
There's so many others. I know that you all worked on Black at the Border, right? That you all, you know, talked about how there are Black people coming over the border. And right now with what we're seeing at the border and the militarization, that it's really important that folks understand that it's a very diverse group of people who are trying to seek asylum and refugee status as well.
Deepa?
Yes.
It's like wild to me the ways in which we have raised Black people globally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like when we talk about Black immigrants, like we're talking about folks are coming from the Caribbean, from the continent, from the African continent, but also Latin America.
Right.
The fact is 90% of enslaved Africans during the Middle Passage actually went to the Latin America and the Caribbean. So there was a ton of Black folks throughout the Americas that are also coming through, that are also part of this process, right? Like, Brazil is the largest concentration of Black people outside of the continent, right? And those folks are always erased. And to us, it's not possible to do this work without really understanding how all of these issues are interconnected, whether it's immigration, racial justice, the fight against Islamophobia, gender justice as well, like really talking about the ways in which like Black immigrant women are subjected to awful abuses, right? Like, I think because of the threats of white supremacy are so varied and agile, right? Like, we have to be able to respond in a way that matches that, right, that intersectionality, right, in the way that matches the ways in which they're using every potential avenue to dispose of our communities, whether that is death, whether that is deportation, whether that is incarceration, right? Like, this is where the fight is.
So we've talked a little bit about, you know, solidarity as a strategy in terms of bringing about co-liberation in various movements. But I also wanted to ask you both to weigh in on our own organizations. And what I mean by that is, Jamia, you talked earlier about the publishing industry and how sometimes it can be very opaque. It can be very difficult to access. I've written one book and, you know, also found that the industry is difficult, you know, and I think for someone like me, who's a woman of color and an immigrant and a first-time full-time writer, it was very hard to understand and figure out. And certainly stories of our communities are hard to lift up and include. So you talked about the publishing industry, and then Jonathan, we have had many conversations, perhaps offline, about the nonprofit industrial complex, so to speak, and how our own organizations have some room to grow, right, when it comes to actually dealing with some of the issues that we are on the front lines addressing. So I'm curious to ask both of you, what are some systemic institutional changes that need to happen within the organizations or industries that we ourselves are working in? I mean, we're always talking about other institutions, right? Like the political system or the capitalist system or whatever, but I'm curious to know about our own, the ones that we are in, the ones that we are trying to change. So Jimmy, if you could talk a little bit about where you think some of those interventions can happen in the publishing industry or the media, because you've talked about both of those.
I'm so excited you brought this up because it's something we're talking about a lot now, because as we get closer to our 50th anniversary, we're working on our strategic plan and really talking about our values as they align with our practices and recognizing that we are a nonprofit publisher, a feminist publisher, and understanding that that gives us a special positioning to be able to disrupt the practices we see in the industry at large and live into the vision we have for the future of feminist publishing. And a big part of the conversations we're having now are on these conversations around what does our code of ethics look like? You know, how do we print our books? Where do we print our books? How do we engage more diverse designers that we're working with freelance to represent the communities that the books are about? And we're in the process of doing things like that. How do we help more debut authors have more sustainability when they write? So that's how we have our Louise Merriweather Prize, where debut authors of color who are non-binary or women have access to a $5,000 advance prize, which is larger than most of the advances that we are usually able to give as a nonprofit publisher, and with the understanding that debut authors will need that support and also who've been systemically left out of the publishing conversation. Also, just what is our role specifically in a landscape where now more mainstream and corporate publishers are starting to talk about feminism more broadly? What is our role in maintaining the integrity of the feminist conversation in media? And what can we do? What kinds of things can we champion that would be left out of those conversations? What kinds of things might now be having a more mainstream moment, but that might be diluting the core issues and systemic issues around the problem?
That's great. I feel like every single entity, philanthropy, you know, the nonprofit sector, media, publishing, all need to do some of those steps or all need to take some of those steps that you're taking. So that's wonderful to see you all doing that. And I also really love the fact that you've mentioned a couple of times now that you don't see yourselves in a silo, that what you all do is hopefully going to impact and influence other publishers and other media entities as well. And Jonathan, what about you? As you know, you're an executive director, and as you think about, you know, the nonprofit sector as well as the attendant, you know, entities around it like philanthropy, what are some ways in which you think we need to have some honest and courageous conversations? What are the topics that we need to be discussing? Because our organizations and our sector is also influenced by white dominant culture. And so how do we kind of break out of that mold?
I mean, it's just been really hard, if I can just be really honest.
Please.
I think, like, for one, I think funding and the philanthropy space, I think plenty of folks are talking about the ways in which it actually, like, continues to replicate some of the systems that we're fighting against, right? Like, I've actually personally encountered some donors that I think have been pretty good and sort of, like, hands-off around, like, expectations around, like, funding. Like some funders in particular that I think we've been able to develop a trust where they're like, hey, what do you need? Like, what work do you think is important? And then I tell them what we think is important. And then they just give us money. And I think that's the kind of, like, relationship that, like, most funders should have with their EITs. But then there are others who are more involved, is what I'm going to say, around, mm-hmm. like, expectations around, like, how money is, like, spent and, like, which parts of the work we think is more important. And that's definitely, like, something that is at times challenging. Like, when we started working or really started putting forth the work that we had been doing on mental wellness, like, I definitely did get some pushback from some funders saying, like, yeah, this is great, but, like, we like, think policy change work is more important. And like really, I think there's like something really essential about like listening to directly impacted voices and having them like sort of determine the priorities that I think at times gets lost in philanthropy. But again, like I think there's a movement to change that, and I've been grateful to be able to see that, but it can't come fast enough.
Right.
If I can be honest. And then I think too, because of who we are as a network, we're a network of currently and formerly undocumented people. That is who we prioritize as a network, and that also translates to our staff positions. There's a equation that we need to like figure out around like how do we hire and employ folks that are from directly impacted communities, right? Like everyone in our team is either like currently or formerly undocumented, and like, there's definitely like challenges to be able to like make that happen. But if we say that we're committed to like investing in these communities, like we need to be having conversations around like what are some of alternatives to employment that we can employ to be able to undocumented folks, right? Like I think that's the conversation that we as a movement need to be more forthcoming about and really prioritize folks that way. And I think the other thing that I don't know that I like intentionally planned this, but every other person besides me at Undocumented like identifies as a woman, and like really seeing that like sort of like how that formed and how that happened, I think it's something that I've been like really like proud of, but also like trying to figure out like what other like aspects or what other parts of the community are we not like sort of like considering or being more intentional about bringing and hiring folks from those communities as well. We can talk about being inclusive in our work, but then that also needs to match like employment decisions, right? And then also even as we talk about organization, how we meet our goals. You know, there's so many ways in which, and I think Demia alluded to this, there's so many ways in which a capitalism like influences like what we view as like good performance or like how what we expect from not just like staff members but also members. Like we begin to view people as a transactional being.
Yes.
And like we only want to get like good products or enough products out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like what we push for and challenge ourselves to think about, again, we're not perfect, but we try to think about like how are we investing in this relationship. Right? How are we like utilizing this relationship as like a model of like the movement that we're trying to build? And that's definitely like it can get messy, but you know it's really important to be able to talk about the ways in which we're undoing some of these systems in our internal aspects of our organizations as well.
I think you also hit so many of the points within the sector, both in terms of being influenced by philanthropy. And I just want to mention, I'm reading a book right now called Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance by Edgar Villanova, who's a Native American who is involved in philanthropy. And I think the book actually really is a call to action and a call to critique around philanthropy. And so just want to lift that up as a model that folks could look at. But then, Jonathan, your points around also within our own sector in terms of who's leading, who's being hired, how productivity has become sort of a lens through which we view people without understanding. And as you point out, like in your organization, folks are dealing with a lot of oppressive structures in their lives. And so really kind of pushing away the models that we're used to is so important. But I also hear you that it's like very difficult work. And I appreciate you saying that, you know, you're not perfect, right? And I think like course correction, there has to be room for that in our movements as well. So I'm going to close up by asking you like both two final questions. You know, we're at the end of this very, you know, as both of you pointed out, very arduous year for, I think, all movements for justice and liberation in this country and around the world. As we move into 2019, what are you both keeping your eyes on? You know, whether it is, for example, the political shifts that we're seeing in Congress, as well as in state legislatures and government, whether it is with emerging organizations, writers, voices, community-based media, or the movements that we've already talked about around immigrant rights, racial justice, Me Too. Can you share, you know, some of the ways in which you're kind of looking ahead to 2019?
So one of our legislative priorities for next year is going to be taking advantage of the fact that we'll have a new House of Representatives with a different majority. We'll be pushing for a joint, for the first time in the history of this country, a joint bill that includes both DREAM and CPS. And this is really important because, as we know, when we talk about immigrant communities, like undocumented young people like myself, we tend to have, like, we tend to enjoy a much broader level of support across the board than like older folks or the other parts of the community, just CPS holders. And I think for this time around, we're actually saying, like, instead of just fighting for the Dream Act, can we talk about, you know, the ways in which CPS holders are actually facing the cost next year? Mm-hmm. And we'll be pushing forward with it for next year. So I would definitely keep an eye out for that. And then in terms of like people and organizations that are doing great work that I'm also looking to, I don't know if you've heard, but there's a group called the Black LGBTQ Migrant Project. They like launched last year, mm-hmm. and they've been doing some incredible like transnational work. I think they were just in Brazil last week talking about the ways in which Korean trans Black migrants are criminalized. And I think mm-hmm. there's like a really deep need to have a transnational approach to movement building that isn't just U.S.-centered. And I'm just like really in awe of like being able to do that. So I'm really excited to see where that goes as well.
Thanks for lifting up both the campaigns as well as organizations that you're looking at. I love that, by the way, to include that for folks to look into. Jamia, what about you?
I'm really excited about what they're calling the Women's Wave and, you know, the amazing turnout that we just saw in November, as well as which needs to grow and the voter suppression that needs to be ended, but also just seeing the gains that we've gotten with so many women paving new ground for others to be lifted up as well as themselves, and seeing that a significant number of women of color ran for office this year, those who won and those who also didn't win but gained momentum to continue to break other ceilings and also build even more robust movements is really exciting for me. I can already feel a change that's happening right now by having new and experienced voices with the issues that affect our communities on the ground, even as Congress people elect who haven't even been sworn in making changes. And I always choose a word for the year for myself and for the world. And my word for the year of 2019, I hope, is accountability.
Oh, I love that.
I'm really hoping that we see accountability in a righteous way happen and that hoping to support movements that are going to do that. And I think one thing I don't want to see happen next year, so I want to say this, to see our movement get distracted by outside temptations to end fights. I think what we're seeing right now is that sometimes we'll see dog whistles happen that will derail us from the common values and goals that we have with each other mm-hmm. and shared interests. And I've seen this with several movements. And when you always kind of see these things bubble up in the media, the question I want to ask everyone is to one, follow the money and follow the source. That's where did this originate? Because that will usually tell you about whether it's true or whether or not there's a motivated agenda behind it being something to divide us. And so what I want to see in 2019 also is more solidarity and more righteous accountability, but also compassion for each other in our movements. That is my hope for us.
That's great. Righteous accountability. That's a phrase that I'm going to borrow from the mashup of a couple of sentences you said, Jamia, and what you talked about as well, Jonathan. So I want to thank you both for this really, really wonderful conversation, because I'm actually left feeling uplifted, even though I know that we all talked about the challenges of the year. I'm also uplifted because of the tremendous work that's happening within sectors and industries and movements, and also to influence systems and policies and practices on the outside. So thank you to both of you for the work that you're individually doing and through your organizations. So grateful to you and to really everybody that has been on this podcast over the year. I've learned so much from everyone. So Jonathan and Jamia, thank you for joining Solidarity Is This.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I want to thank all of you for listening to Solidarity Is This, for subscribing, downloading, referring the podcast to your own networks. Please continue to do so. You can hear the podcast on iTunes or your podcast platform. You can also download the Solidarity Syllabus, which is available at www.solidarityis.org. I want to end our podcast this month, and indeed the podcast for 2018, with a quote from Asatha Shakur. She wrote, "We need a revolution of the mind. We need a revolution of the heart. We need a revolution of the spirit. The power of the people is stronger than any weapon. A people's revolution can't be stopped. We need to be weapons of mass construction, weapons of mass love. It's not enough just to change the system. We need to change ourselves. With that, I hope that you have a peaceful, compassionate end of this year, and I will see you all again in 2019 on Solidarity Is This.